Have a wonderful day.
This is VOA News. I'm Tommy McNeil. An incident over the Black Sea has further raised tensions over Russia's war in Ukraine, this time involving an American drone. AP correspondent Sagar Magani reports.
U.S. surveillance drone was flying a mission over the Black Sea.
This MQ-9 was operating in international airspace over international waters and posed a threat to nobody.
But the National Security Council's John Kirby says two Russian fighter jets flew near the drone.
It is not the first time, certainly in recent weeks, that there's been intercepts. It is the first time that an intercept resulted in the splashing of one of our drones.
Brigadier General Pat Ryder, the Pentagon's chief spokesman, says one of the Russian jets hit the MQ-9's propeller.
Because of the damage, we were in a position to have to essentially crash it into the Black Sea.
Russia denies its plane struck the drone. Sagar Magani, Washington.
AP correspondent Matt Lee explains in an AP interview that it's not uncommon for the U.S. to fly drones in the area, that the downing is a major issue.
Don't expect that this is going to rise to the level of some kind of, major conflagration, direct conflagration between the two sides.
Honduras's president says that her government will seek to establish diplomatic relations with China, which would imply severing relations with Taiwan. She said in a Twitter account Tuesday that she instructed the Honduran Foreign Affairs Minister to start negotiations with China and that her intention is to expand the borders with freedom. Honduras is one of the few remaining allies of Taiwan, and Castro's announcement represents a change of its diplomatic views. China claims self-ruled democratic Taiwan as its own. This is VOA News. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan faces what analysts say is his biggest electoral challenge in May, elections by a man many call the Turkish Gandhi. Dorian Jones reports from Istanbul.
Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu, leader of the country's main opposition, CHP party, announced his presidential candidacy in early March. He promises sweeping reform to curb the power of the presidency and return parliamentary democracy. But critics point out that the softly spoken Kılıçdaroğlu lacks the fiery charisma of Erdogan. However, analysts say February's deadly earthquakes are a political game changer, with outrage rising over construction failings and allegations of a slow government response. Dorian Jones for VOA News, Istanbul.
Hundreds of Israeli writers, artists, and intellectuals have called on Germany and Britain to cancel upcoming visits by Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, saying that his plan to overhaul Israel's judicial system has put the country on a destructive course. AP correspondent Karen Chamas.
Knesset Speaker Amir Ohana announces that the legislation to weaken Israel's Supreme Court was accepted by a parliament vote and will be passed to the Special Committee of Amendments. Israeli demonstrators blocked roads to government offices in Jerusalem the following day. The move gives Netanyahu's coalition control over the appointment of the nation's judges. They say the plan is a long overdue measure to curb what they see as outsized influence by unelected judges. But critics say the plan will destroy Israel's fragile system of checks and balances by concentrating power in the hands of Netanyahu and his parliamentary majority. I'm Karen Chamas.
An unrelenting cyclone, Freddy, that is currently battering southern Africa has killed at least 56 people in Malawi and Mozambique since it struck the continent for a second time. Authorities in both countries have confirmed. Local police said that 51 people in Malawi, including 36 in a financial hub in the center of the country, have died, with several others missing or injured. Authorities in Mozambique reported that 5 people were killed in the country since Saturday. The cyclone lashed over Mozambique and Malawi over the weekend and into Monday. It is the second time the record-breaking cyclone, which has been causing destruction in southern Africa since late February, made landfall in mainland Africa. Facebook parent Meta will slash another 10,000 jobs and will not fill 5,000 open positions as the social media pioneer cuts costs. Company said Tuesday will reduce the size of its recruiting team and then make further cuts in its tech groups in late April and then its business groups in late May. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Today is Wednesday, March 15th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I am Chinua Dofo in Washington. Coming up in the next half hour, tension as the U.S. spy drone crashes after interception by Russian jets.
Approximately 7:03 a.m. Central European time, one of the Russian Su-27 aircraft struck the propeller of the MQ-9, causing U.S. forces to have to bring the MQ-9 down in international waters.
The U.S. agrees to sell nuclear-powered submarines to Australia to boost Asia-Pacific security.
As we stand at the inflection point in history, the United States can ask for no better partners in the Indo-Pacific, where so much of our shared future will be written.
And Pakistan police and supporters of Imran Khan fight pitched battles outside the former prime minister's home. We'll have these stories and more next on International Edition. Stay tuned. A U.S. military MQ-9 surveillance drone crashed into the Black Sea on Tuesday after being intercepted by Russian fighter jets in the first such incident since Russia's invasion of Ukraine over a year ago. Zachary Goldman of Reuters reports.
An American MQ-9 Reaper surveillance drone was forced to crash into the Black Sea on Tuesday after two Russian fighter jets performed what the U.S. called a, quote, reckless intercept. Air Force Brigadier General Pat Ryder is the Pentagon press secretary.
Approximately 7:03 a.m. Central European time, one of the Russian Su-27 aircraft struck the propeller of the MQ-9, causing U.S. forces to have to bring the MQ-9 down in international waters. Several times before the collision, the Su-27s dumped fuel on and flew in front of the MQ-9 in a reckless and unprofessional manner. This incident demonstrates a lack of competence in addition to being unsafe and unprofessional.
It was the first such incident since Russia's invasion of Ukraine over a year ago and drew condemnation from the White House and the Pentagon, which warned of the risk of escalation. U.S. Army General Christopher Cavoli briefed NATO allies about the incident. The U.S. Air Force said the drone was conducting an intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance, or ISR, mission. The Pentagon noted that the MQ-9 can carry weaponry, but declined to comment on whether this particular drone was armed. The spokesperson would only say the incident occurred in international airspace and noted the Russian jets involved did not leave the collision unscathed.
We assess that it likely caused some damage to the Russian aircraft as well. To our knowledge, well, we know that the Russian aircraft did land. I'm not going to go into where they landed. But again, it's just demonstrative of very unprofessional, unsafe airmanship on the part of these pilots.
The U.S. military said the incident followed a pattern of dangerous behavior by Russian pilots operating near aircraft flown by the U.S. and its allies, including over the Black Sea. The White House said the drone's downing was unique, however, and would be raised directly with Moscow.
That's Zachary Goldman of Reuters, and Russia's defense ministry said on Tuesday that its fighter jets did not come into contact with the U.S. drone that crashed into the Black Sea earlier, and claiming instead that the drone crashed due to what it called, quote, sharp maneuvering, unquote. The defense ministry said, quote, Russian fighters did not use their onboard weapons, did not come into contact with the UAV, and returned safely to their home airfield, unquote. Australia will buy three nuclear-powered submarines from the United States as part of a three-nation multi-decade deal with Great Britain that is aimed at strengthening the Allies' presence at the Asian-Pacific region as China grows bolder militarily. VOA's Anita Powell reports from Washington.
President Joe Biden says the decision to share sensitive U.S. nuclear technology with Australia is a big deal and a necessary one. He spoke Monday in San Diego.
As we stand at the inflection point in history, where the hard work of enhancing deterrence and promoting stability is going to affect the prospect of peace for decades to come, the United States can ask for no better partners in the Indo-Pacific, where so much of our shared future will be written. Forging this new partnership, we're showing again how democracies can deliver our own security and prosperity. And not just for us, but for the entire world.
The multi-decade deal will see American and British nuclear-powered submarines rotating into Australian waters as soon as 2027. By the early 2030s, Australia will buy at least three, and as many as five, American nuclear-powered conventionally armed submarines designed to hunt and attack other subs. And the three nations will work together to develop a new nuclear attack submarine, a project that could take two decades. Biden stressed that the deal concerns nuclear propulsion, not arms, and the leaders pledged to adhere to their nuclear non-proliferation agreements. Australian Prime Minister Anthony Albanese said the deal, which could cost nearly $150 billion, will create jobs and boost innovation and research.
The AUKUS agreement we confirm here in San Diego represents the biggest single investment in Australia's defence capability in all of our history, strengthening Australia's national security and stability in our region.
And British Prime Minister Rishi Sunak also announced that his nation would increase military spending to 2.5% of their GDP to meet growing threats worldwide.
In the last 18 months, the challenges we face have only grown. Russia's illegal invasion of Ukraine, China's growing assertiveness, the destabilizing behavior of Iran and North Korea, all threaten to create a world defined by danger, disorder, and division. Faced with this new reality, it is more important than ever that we strengthen the resilience of our own countries.
Beijing has criticized the partnership and accuses Washington of provoking rivalry and confrontation. But analysts say China's aggression in the Pacific region prompted this decision. Mark Kennedy is director of the WABA Institute for Strategic Competition at the Wilson Center. He spoke to VOA on Zoom.
This is really more a response to the very aggressive military buildup that China has had, as opposed to anything we're doing that would be provoking to China.
Because the three countries are democracies, there are vocal critics, and analysts expect legislators in all three nations to probe the terms of the deal as it evolves and question its impact on sovereignty issues and government spending. Charles Liddell is the inaugural Australia chair at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. He spoke to VOA on Zoom.
There's criticism, as well there should be, of this deal everywhere, because that's how democracies do policy, right? The ambitions are really, really large, but there are also very large bets that are being placed.
And here's who they're betting against. The man who recently cemented his status as the most powerful leader China has had in decades. Can these two young nations meet that challenge alongside their former colonial master? AUKUS hopes so. Anita Powell, VOA News, Washington.
Thank you, Anita. North Korea conducted a ballistic missile launch Tuesday. Is the latest in a flurry of North Korean weapons tests and condemnation of U.S.-South Korea joint military drills that began this week. More from VOA's Bill Gallo in Seoul.
North Korea launched two short-range ballistic missiles into the sea off its east coast, that from South Korea's military, which condemned the launch as a threat to regional security. The launch came a day after North Korea said it successfully fired two strategic cruise missiles from a submarine, the first time it has claimed such a feat. Over the past year, North Korea has launched an unprecedented number of missiles. The United States and its ally South Korea have responded by increasing joint military exercises. On Monday, the two sides began 11 days of major drills, including some of their largest in 5 years. On Monday, U.S. State Department spokesman Ned Price said North Korea's expanded weapons tests have helped lead to the bigger joint military exercises.
We're not going to let any steps North Korea take deter us or constrain us from the actions that we feel are necessary to safeguard stability on the Korean Peninsula.
The United States and South Korea say the exercises are defensive, but North Korea views the drills as preparation to invade and often uses them as an occasion to conduct its own major weapons tests. Last week, North Korean leader Kim Jong-un vowed to take powerful and offensive steps in response to the U.S.-South Korea actions, which he said are reaching a red line. Bill Gallo, VOA News, Seoul.
Sudan says it will host Russia's first naval base in Africa, despite opposition from the West, as soon as the country completes its transition from military to civilian rule. But while some Sudanese support the businesses that a base will bring, local tribal leaders are opposed to any foreign military presence. Harry Wilkins reports from Port Sudan in Sudan.
Port Sudan is Sudan's vital link to the Red Sea, a body of water strategically important for global powers and the countries that surround it, not least for its access to the Suez Canal. Port Sudan made headlines in February after Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov visited Sudan. During the visit, the Sudanese junta, which took power in a military coup in 2021, promised Russia a new naval base in the city. But local tribal leaders, who carry a big influence on the Red Sea coast, have other ideas. Mohammed Kara Kubar says he and other local leaders are against the Russian base.
They refuse because they want just to put their hand and stop our port, I think. No investment. They have tribe they have refused any military in our part.
In February, Middle East Eye, a news website based in London, reported that Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo, a powerful Sudanese militia leader, attempted to open military bases along the Red Sea coast, but was prevented by local tribal leaders after they demanded money for development. A small Russian logistics base is reported to have been set up in Port Sudan in the past, but according to local media and residents, it ceased operation in 2021. In the vicinity of the old base, in the Flamingo district of the city, one local declined to give his name when VOA asked if he supported the Russian naval base. He says if a Russian naval base is in Sudanese interests, he wouldn't have a problem with it. I don't care who's involved, whether they are British, Russian or Americans, he added. One analyst said there has been talk of a full-fledged Russian naval base in Port Sudan for years, yet it has never materialized. Cameron Hudson is with the Center for Strategic and International Studies, a Washington-based think tank.
The case of the missing naval base has been around for many years. This base has been promised to have been built, I don't know how many times now, five or six times.
Another analyst thinks the base could go ahead if Sudan's ruling junta is determined to make it happen. Hala Al-Karib is with the Strategic Initiative for Women in the Horn of Africa.
I don't know. I think it very much depends on the naval base. It's very much depends on the direction that the political process is going to take. You know, so if the regime is actually moving towards consolidating a 100% military power in Sudan.
Sudan already has well-established links with Russia and the Russian paramilitary group Wagner. Sudan's junta is reported to be trading the country's gold in exchange for Russian weapons. Henry Wilkins for VOA News, Port Sudan, Sudan.
In other news in Pakistan, a government spokesman and witnesses say police and supporters of Imran Khan fought pitched battles outside the former prime minister's home in Lahore on Tuesday, wounding several on both sides ahead of his expected arrest. Police hit supporters of Khan in with baton charges and lobbed tear gas canisters, some of which landed on the lawns of Khan's home, according to a video released by his party. This is VOA's International Edition. I am Chinedu Afo in Washington. U.S. Secretary of State Anthony Blinken is in Addis Ababa for talks with Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed after ties between the two countries broke down amid reports of war crimes committed in the northern part of Tigray. Secretary Blinken will also visit Niger later this week. Sarah Yeager is the Washington-based director of Human Rights Watch. She tells VOA's Carol Van Dam the right group worries that Blinken will normalize U.S. relations with Ethiopia without holding the government responsible for atrocities committed during the country's two-year civil war, in which hundreds of thousands of civilians were killed.
Secretary Blinken has a history of being very strong and forceful in holding perpetrators of human rights abuses accountable. He has done that in Burma. He's done that in other places. The suffering, as you note, in Ethiopia has been catastrophic proportions. So we are concerned, actually, that the United States government is going to normalize its relations with Ethiopia and that Secretary Blinken will not have that kind of public or private tough message.
About that, what should be the minimum threshold for normalizing relations with Ethiopia, do you think?
I think Addis should have a very long way to go to get normalized relations with the United States. The United States Secretary Blinken and President Biden have been very strong in their rhetoric about democracy and human rights. But what we've seen in Ethiopia is a backsliding on democracy. Absolutely. And of course, these atrocities in Tigray and in other regions, and those atrocities, the abuses are ongoing. And so at the very minimum, they need to stop. We have seen detentions. We have seen sexual violence. All of this after the secession of hostilities agreement. The secession of hostilities agreement has brought some relief to some populations, and that's important. We do want to give credit where credit is due. But again, abuses are ongoing, aid cannot get to certain places. Help for victims of sexual violence is nowhere to be seen. Detentions continue. There's a lot that needs to happen before the U.S. and Ethiopia should have that kind of handshake of a friendly relationship.
We have heard those reports, too, where people are still being raped and killed, civilians in Ethiopia, well after the peace deal was signed in November. So what does Blinken sit down and say to Abiy Ahmed? What does he say?
I think Blinken needs to demand an immediate end to abuses of civilians across Ethiopia from President Abiy. And I think what I would really like for Secretary Blinken to say is, look, we've got intelligence and documentation of atrocities from the past 2+ years of this happening in your country. We need you to know that we can make an atrocity determination based on what we have, and we will. That's what I hope he will say.
A lot of people have a problem with Secretary Blinken sitting down with the Prime Minister, Abiy Ahmed, just sitting down with him even, if he's the guy in charge of these forces who committed all these atrocities. He may not have done it with his own two hands, but he was in charge. So how do you rectify that?
I mean, Human Rights Watch is not against engagement or diplomatic engagement. Sometimes that is the way that you need to go in order to get accountability and justice. It's really a matter of how you use that engagement. So if he's going to sit down with Prime Minister Abiy, he is going to need to have some very, I hope, strong words about the ongoing abuses and certainly the atrocities that happened before. And it is not just Abiy and Ethiopian authorities. There are lots of warring parties involved here, including Eritrean forces, Tigrayan forces. You know, this is a complicated situation, and there are many victims from many of those warring parties. Justice is needed for all of them.
That's Human Rights Watch Washington Director Sarah Yeager speaking with my colleague Carol Van Dam. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan faces what analysts say is his biggest electoral challenge in May elections by a man many have dubbed the Turkish Gandhi. Dorian Jones reports from Istanbul.
Backed by 6 parties drawn from across the political spectrum, Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu, leader of the country's main opposition, CHP party, announced his presidential candidacy in early March. He promises sweeping reform to curb the power of the presidency and return parliamentary democracy. So explains Halk TV news editor-in-chief Bengü Sharp Baba Eker. She says, Kılıçdaroğlu says, I will not rule as one man. I will rule with consensus. He's promising economic stability and a Turkey that respects human rights, where everyone is represented equally. And we should remember that Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu has been in politics and in state bureaucracy for a very long time. Yet, despite this, there has been no accusation of corruption. Hiç şaibe henüz bulunamamış bir siyasi figür. 74-year-old Kılıçdaroğlu brought his CHP party back from the dead. His 400-kilometre march for justice from Ankara to Istanbul over the jailing of government critics morphed into one of the first major mass movements against President Recep Tayyip Erdogan's rule. Kılıçdaroğlu masterminded municipal election victories in 4 out of 5 of Turkey's largest cities, including Erdogan's political fortress, Istanbul. But critics point out that the softly spoken Kılıçdaroğlu, who comes from the civil service, lacks the fiery charisma of Erdogan. However, analysts say February's deadly earthquakes are a political game changer, with outrage rising over construction failings and allegations of a slow government response. Kılıçdaroğlu, some analysts say, is capturing the country's mood. Sezin Erne is a columnist at Politikyol news portal.
He said that there's something going on wrong with this whole system, so we must start something new altogether. We must change this country for the better, once and for all, because there are a lot of things that are going wrong.
Religion could be another obstacle for Kılıçdaroğlu. He comes from the liberal Alevi Islamic sect, which some conservative Muslims consider heretical. Alevis have faced centuries of discrimination in Turkey, but analysts suggest after 20 years of Erdogan's rule, dominated by tensions between the religious and secular, the electorate are now more interested in economic concerns than identity politics. Political scientist Zeynep Alamdar of Istanbul's Okan University.
I think the country has moved on in terms of, or especially the young people have moved on in terms of not looking at what the what the other believes in. I mean, the economy is in shambles. You know, the inflation rate is amazing. The currency crisis is there. The debt is mounting.
With Kılıçdaroğlu's coalition of parties that includes nationalists, Islamists, the left and right, he promises an end to political and ethnic polarization in what many see as the biggest challenge to Erdogan's rule. Dorian Jones for VOA News, Istanbul.
Hi, I'm Kim Lewis. Join me and our panel of journalists as we discuss the top stories of the week, including President Biden assured Americans that the U.S. banking system is safe after the collapse of two major banks over the last few days. We'll discuss what steps the U.S. government will take to protect small businesses and workers. Be sure to tune in to Issues in the News this Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
This has been International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you so much for listening. Visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours at voanews.com and check out voaafrica.com for more English language programming. You can find International Edition on our current affairs programs, Encounter, Press Conference USA, and Issues in the News on voanews.com. Until next time, I am Gina Duofo in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The situation in Libya is not stable due to energy disruptions, political strife, and violence. The only viable path to peace in Libya is enabling the Libyan people to choose their own leaders in national elections, said Ambassador Robert Wood, alternate representative for special political affairs at the United Nations.
We welcome the progress Libyans have made in the Egypt-hosted constitutional tract, in which Libyan leaders resolved many issues needed to hold elections. Now it is time to build on these achievements and move forward with a UN-facilitated effort to secure broad political consensus and enable successful elections in Libya.
Building political will among all of Libya's leaders to make the hard decisions and move elections forward remains a challenge, warned Ambassador Wood. But now is the time to restore momentum, he urged. Toward that end, the United States will continue to support the work of the High National Elections Commission. Progress on the political track must be accompanied by progress on the economic and security tracks, added Ambassador Wood.
The development of a revenue management mechanism and progress in reunifying Libya's central bank will provide transparency and accountability so that the people of Libya can see how Libya's wealth is being spent.
Ambassador Wood called for the immediate withdrawal from Libya of all foreign fighters and mercenaries, including the Russian Wagner Group mercenaries. At the same time, the United States is deeply concerned by the plight of migrants in Libya. We are saddened by the continued loss of life on the Mediterranean and appalled by the inhumane treatment of migrants detained in official and unofficial detention centers, said Ambassador Wood.
We call for respect for the human rights of migrants. We support the continued work of the Commission of Inquiry and call on Libyan leaders to cooperate fully with it and with humanitarian organizations.
Libyans deserve to choose their own leaders in a government that leads to peace, stability, and prosperity. The United States stands ready to help Libya achieve those goals.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.